Continuing with David Morrison, February 72 at Madone. Now, you say in your first year at Caltech, just after the 90 foots had been built, you were liaison between...
Yeah, resident dog's body, as it were.
at the Owens Valley Observatory. And at that time, I think there were probably two main programs then. To measure accurate positions of radio sources for identifications. At that time, there were very few identifications. And also to measure brightness distributions. And so various people were involved. Moffitt and later Maltby were working on the angular brightness distributions. And the identification work, there were a vast number of people involved.
Yeah.
But,
Matthews was...
Yeah.
Was there a cooperative program with Palomar for them to take plates? And
yes, there's a lot of very close contact, yeah. I mean, we shared the same offices,
yeah.
The same building. And, yeah, so there's very, very close cooperation between the two. And I think this led to the first radio star, 3C48, I think, probably was.
First quasar, you mean?
Yeah. With the exception of 3C273, I'm not sure which came first.
Right, Schmidt, well, let's see, they were first identified by Schmidt, just happening to notice that if you put this tremendous redshift on these things, then...
Right.
And the spectral lines made sense.
But his attention was drawn to these things because of the identifications in that stage. He just thought perhaps they really were radio stars, I think,
yeah.
Until he explained the spectrum in terms of the redshift. And then, of course, after about a year, after that first year, Bolton left, he went back to run the 210-foot. And Gordon Stanley took over as director. And during this period, Rad was there, of course. He'd been there already a year when I arrived. And I'm trying to remember what in fact we did.
Okay, and 21 centimeter interferometry, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, at that time there's a lot of interest in trying to measure the Zeeman splitting of the hydrogen neutral hydrogen line due to the galactic magnetic field. And we spent quite a bit of time using the interferometer there.
I see.
To
who was we?
Oh, it was Rad, Bob Wilson, of Penzias and Wilson fame, and myself and Barry Clark, who's never been there.
This was not ever published, was it?
Yeah, there was some. Well, the thing was, Rod Davis and company at Jodrell kept sort of publishing values for the magnetic field found this way.
Yeah, but and then the score was still there.
This might have been before he even appeared.
I see, even before he was in the scene.
But it was around about that time. And Sander Weiner had just used his newly developed autocorrelation receiver to try and do the same thing. And he got an upper limit, much lower than the report general values. And we couldn't see anything either, so...
These general values were published?
Yeah.
In Nature, anyway.
I've forgotten where. It might even have been nothing else's. So there's a lot of dispute at that time about whether this galactic magnetic field had really been measured or not. But we rapidly reached the stage where we'd have to integrate for a lifetime to make any improvement. We only had one channel, receiver.
Yeah.
We had to scan this across
the
line.
Yeah.
And this took forever. So we sort of lost interest in this. Although Rad and Barry Clark went on to try and measure the distribution of neutral hydrogen across the face of radio sources. I forgot now, I may have helped them a little bit in the early stages of that. Another thing we were involved, Rad and I, at that stage there was a lot of effort in trying to measure linear polarization in radio sources. And we made some unsuccessful
We looked at some of the, we looked at the Crab Nebula. We were able to see some linear polarization there. We looked at the strongest sources at about 21 centimeters, around about that frequency, and we couldn't find anything. And we were beaten to the draw by Connie Mayer.
Yeah,
I was at, at 3 centimeters, I guess.
Just going to ask you that. I mean, were you sort of in competition with them? And
Was it just a matter of if you observe at 21 centimeters and you take the six most intense sources, you find there's very little polarization. But if we kept on a bit harder and gone to the next weakest sources, we should have seen something.
I see.
And
was your sensitivity about the same as Mayer's? Your sensitivity in terms of polarization?
Well, he was lucky. He looked at Cygnus at 3 centimeters, where it's very quite strongly polarized, I think 8% polarized. But it drops, the polarization of Cygnus there drops extremely rapidly. Oh, yeah, and about this time, of course, Breswell found polarization in Centaurus A in the Southern Hemisphere. And there's a lot of politics involved in that. A lot of dirty linen there, which has been hidden away, I think.
Well, speak away, if you wish.
No, I don't really. I'm sure somebody else will tell you about that. Well, I wasn't. I mean, you should speak to somebody who's actually in Australia when this happened. But the story was, I'll tell you the story I heard, which of course may not be the truth. And the story was that they just started up the 210-foot dish, and Breslin was just visiting. At that time he was working in California. He was just visiting, and the story goes that the dish was pointed at Centaurus, and they got this new, they just installed this rotatable feed so they can change the linear polarization. And he said, "What's that button?" And they said, "Oh, that changes the polarization." So he pressed the button, you see, and the power intensity of this thing varied an awful lot. It was very strongly polarized. And I think, therefore, I think he more or less sat down, according to, I think, and wrote a letter to Nature saying this, you see. And the people in Australia had done all the work to make this horn feed rotator, and they were very annoyed about this. And there was a lot of arguments and horse trading went on. That's just the basis you can explore that.
Breswell was, like you say, just visiting.
I think that was the story.
Where was he at the time? Is Stanford?
He'd already been at Stanford for some time, I think. Just passing through.
But there was no Australian program to look for polarization Centaurus either. It was just that...
They must have had this in mind.
Well, that's right.
Installed this field.
Yeah, I guess obviously, yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think the story was that, he went out and wrote a letter to Nature without telling anybody there. I think the letter was sort of suppressed until somebody, Cooper and Price, I think.
I see. And done it privately.
And they did a good job, and they were the first to measure Faraday rotation, I think, on the radiation.
I see.
This letter got in first.
Was it Cooper and Price? Both in Nature?
I think it's Cooper and
Price. This is about 64 or so, I guess. Something like that.
Oh, it'd be before that. It'd be 61 or 62, I think.
Something like that, okay.
So anyway, we were in on this polarization right from the beginning there, and we pressed ahead with measuring rotation measures, and we were just fortunate there. Gardner and Whitaker, I guess, they found a correlation with galactic latitude, and we just had a few more sources, and we were able to show that there was a correlation with galactic longitude too, which showed there was something funny about the magnetic field that seemed to be in opposite directions above and below the galactic plane. We also tried to... George Seelstadt came along about that time, and we got involved in trying to measure the distribution of polarization over radio sources by using interferometers. And we made a few preliminary steps, though nothing like these people can do nowadays. And what else happened?
That was the first polarization done in interferometry. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, I don't know. Well, no. No, many years before that, at meter wavelengths, people had looked for polarization. Henry Brown, Palmer and Thompson, I think.
I see.
They looked at meter wavelengths, and Ryle probably too. Sort of in the early days, when observations tended to be made at meter wavelengths, people looked, but in general they're You know, 1% and 5% were the sort of limits they put on it. And of course, I don't think anybody yet has measured the linear polarization down there. So.
Well, what other goodies were going on at Caltech?
Well, I've been talking to a large extent the things I was concerned with. Of course, the brightness distribution in radio sources. I think this work showed that the fact that radio sources would double was a very common occurrence. I mean, it had been known in the case of Cygnus A.
This was the first one to bring it out statistically.
It showed that a large majority, probably the majority.
This is where the CTA catalog, the CTB catalog came out, or is that?
They were done very early. They were the first things that were done.
Were the interferometers?
No.
Or just a single dish?
Single dish. She said they got one dish working first, and they did some cataloging.
I see.
Plotting out the galactic plane. So, yes. I think Bob Bilson did some. He did some interferometry on one of the. Yeah, I'm not sure what he did. What else happened? Oh, that's right, yeah. We did some work on Jupiter around about that stage. The non-thermal microwave radiation from Jupiter had been discovered, and its polarization.
Who discovered? Burke discovered the decametric.
Yes,
right. You're saying the microwave.
The microwave, yes. This was discovered essentially by the NRL people, Slonecker and Mayer and people like that.
No, I didn't even realize that.
Yes, they... with a 50-foot antenna. They were looking at the planets.
So...
And they found that Jupiter had a large excess. The spectrum wasn't thermal.
Now, were you observing Jupiter interferometrically?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what came out of that?
Yes, I think it was Radhakrishnan and Roberts. Jim Roberts, of course, was at Caltech at this stage too, and he was involved in a lot of the position work and the surveys, CTA, I think, Harris and Roberts. And he and Radhakrishnan, I think Drake suggested this non-thermal radiation came from the Van Allen belts, which had been discovered around the Earth just before then. So, that was things to do. If you were bright anyway, was to look for polarization and radiation.
You mean Van Allen belts around Jupiter?
Around Jupiter.
Similar things, yeah.
And I think Radhakrishnan and Roberts were the first to show that polarization was present. That's right. They published a Physical Review letter article on that. And, this happened in 1960, I guess. And in 1961, I sort of took over this Jupiter work, because Roberts went back to Australia. And Rad was getting much more involved in hydrogen line work, I think, at that stage. So Glenn Berg and I we pursued this polarization lark a bit more. And at one stage, we were looking for circular polarization. Trying to find circular polarization. As the thing, as the planet spun around, we thought we might get an excess of one hand over the other when one pole was near to the Earth, the line of sight to the Earth. And, what time is your...
6 o'clock, the best way, so about 10 minutes.
So we were looking for circular polarization, and we found linear polarization varying. And we were able to show that the position angle polarization varied plus or minus 10 degrees or something as the planet rotated.
Mm-hmm.
So we said this is because the dipole moment is at an angle of about 10 degrees to the rotational axis of Jupiter. And at that stage, we thought, circular polarization, all the theorists at that stage said it was synchrotron radiation was linearly polarized, and there's very little, if any, circular polarization. So we forgot about circular polarization. And that's right, we started looking for Jim Warwick at Boulder at this stage advanced the idea that Jupiter's dipole moment, although Well, we'd shown it was inclined to the rotational axis. He on the basis of the drifting low-frequency bursts, proposed the theory that Jupiter's dipole moment was actually off-center as well, displaced by a substantial fraction of the radius. So Blinberg and I tried to find this using the interferometer, and we thought we'd found it. We were trying to measure the... the relative position of the thermal source. I think this is what we're trying to do. The planet's surface. Mm-hmm. We're trying to measure a displacement between that and the non-thermal source. Right.
Something rotated. Yeah.
And we thought we'd found this, you see. So we published a paper on this. And the irony of it is that it turned out that it was actually circular polarization that we were seeing. We interpreted it in terms of a shifting source of linear polarization, there was actually a fixed source of circular polarization which came and went as the planet rotated.
I see.
Because first you saw the North Pole, then the South Pole.
And where was that paper published in?
I think it was a note or something in Astrophysical Journal. And Eakers and Roberts in Australia took this up, and using a single dish, they were able to show that the radio source did not move to and fro by what we said. And
where did they publish their?
That I don't remember. Oh, wait a minute! It might have been in Icarus, or one of these.
Yeah.
Solar system.
I can ask around. Yeah.
Solar system. So that sort of shot us down in flames, and then at about that time I left Australia. I left California and sailed with Rad to Australia. And in the meantime, Blinberg continued this work, and he was able to show it definitely was circular polarization.
This was your first major sailing trip?
Yes, yeah.
And how long did you take?
It took about 18 months altogether.
18 months, yes. Mm-hmm. And what year was this?
We left in 64. May, probably.
Were there any other astronomers involved besides?
Yes, Dan Harris, who graduated from Caltech. And then he went to Bologna for a year or two. And when he finished at Bologna, he joined us in England. He sailed with us to the West, as far as the West Indies. And then he took a job at Cornell, Arecibo.
I see.
And we picked up another friend of Rad's.
Now, where did you sail from?
From England.
Oh, from England, through the Panama Canal to Australia. I see. No wonder it took 18 months.
Yeah.
And then both you and Rad began working at Parkes then?
Yes. And so partly taking off from starting again where I left off in California. Jim Roberts, of course, was still in Australia at this stage. And a lot of interest was expressed in circular polarization from radio sources at that time, so it seemed a good thing to search for. So we spent quite a bit of time looking for circular polarization in radio sources, and as a sideline and a guarantee of success, we also looked at Jupiter, and we were able to show sure enough there was some circular polarization in the radiation from Jupiter, but we couldn't detect any in the radio source, external, the other radio sources we looked at, and we put limits on it. And, well, yeah, a lot of people were involved in that time, but a lot of people lost interest in this.
Yeah.
And it's only in the last few years that interest has been, well, some people have kept up an interest, and they finally discovered circular polarization in some external radio galaxies, quasars rather. So, yes, I've probably forgotten some things. I'm sure I have, yeah.
Well, you were at Parkes for how long? For
4 years.
4 years. Mm. Did you work on anything else besides the circular polarization?
Oh, yes. John Wartok and myself did some... They also have a 60-foot dish at Parkes,
right,
on railway tracks, which are rather short railway tracks. And at that stage, it only worked at 21 centimetres and 408. That's right, yeah. And Ron Eakers and John Bolton had been doing sort of southern hemisphere version of what they've been done at Caltech on brightness distributions. And this is Ronnie Cruz's thesis material. And John Whitehook and I tried to measure the distribution of linear polarization at 21 centimeters over a few sources. And then we tried our best and we did a lousy sort of job. The interferometer wasn't phase stable. And I think we could only do a one-dimensional distribution as well at that time. So it wasn't really, it didn't really show very much. And so most of my time was involved in measurements of the linear polarization of radio sources to try and measure Faraday rotation to plot out the galactic magnetic field. And the variation of linear polarization of the wavelength and so on is obviously of interest.
Yeah.
I think it's probably in the future anyway, it's going to prove rather quite important. Yes, and then towards the end, that's right, yes, the last couple of years. I mean, while I was in Australia, pulsars were discovered. 1967, wasn't it? Yeah. And there was a terrific rush to everybody was observing pulsars. And I stayed clear of that, and then things have quietened down quite a lot. Max Komisarov was really the most interested in this at this time, although Rad was in the background all the time. And Max said, would I help him? So I gave him some help. At that stage we were trying to record photographically, and we wasted a lot of time trying to get things on film.
I see. Well, I think I better go. Mm. So at this stage you went on your trip with Miller Goss and
yes.
Your wife. Were there any other astronomers in that?
No,
that one?
No, no.
And then you spent 6 months in Japan and we've talked about that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
So that's my life story.
Right.
In a nutshell.
That ends the interview with David Morris on 4th February 72.